let's free associate for a second. If I say meat, do you say potatoes? And then, if you had to pick, what political party would someone who enjoys meat and potatoes belong to? Oh, you think you know, huh? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. You probably have some kind of unconscious bias, even about the political nature of the very food and products we buy. And we're going to dig into that in this episode, our last before Election Day. We'll answer the economic questions you have before you vote, look at how the economy and the election feel in three places around the country, plus making her radio debut. That's Suzanne. She is a chicken and my new friend. As always, come share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. We will start this show, as we often do, with a little long and short. That's where we borrow terms from the world of finance and ask our guests to go long, that is, bet on something, or short and bet against it. We do this for topics in the news. This week, we have Danielle Belton, managing editor of The Root, and Marketplace's Washington correspondent, Kimberly Adams. Thank you both for being here.
Aw, thank you for having me.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hello, everybody. Okay, Danielle, since you are here in the studio with me, I'm going to let you go first. Welcome, New York resident, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I am a New York resident.
You're
that is
New
correct.
You're a New York resident. Very exciting. What are you long for us?
I am long on voter suppression. I'm not excited about being long on that, but it's a reality that we're facing as a country. I mean, as the country continues to grow browner, you have more Black and Latinos in the United States. And at this point, right now, Black and brown people overwhelmingly vote Democratic. And so you have all these issues where instead of going, hey, let's like try to like fairly compete for the Black vote, like maybe there's a way that we can like put a wrench in it. So like there's all these instances that keep popping up across
the country. There are a lot of legal challenges.
Yes, there's lots of legal challenges. I mean, pretty much ever since the VRA, the Voting Rights Act, was gutted with Shelby versus Holder, there's been all these like voter ID laws and voter suppression laws that have popped up across the United States. And so even in places where voter ID has been struck down, you still have problems like in Texas where people are showing up at polling places and folks are demanding to see their ID and turning voters away. You have the North Carolina NAACP right now is suing over a purge of voter rolls in North Carolina that the NAACP is arguing has disproportionately affected people of color. And then the big news that came out this Wednesday in Politico, it was this actual mass mobilization effort by white supremacists to go out to polling places in predominantly Black and brown areas and intimidate voters and try to suppress the vote that way.
Kimberly, your long also kind of knits in with Danielle's long here.
Yes, I am long on election drama, even though the election will be over soon. The drama surrounding it is just going to stay with us. The legal challenges that are going to be probably inevitable after this vote because people think it's rigged or because of some sort of, you know, allegations of fraud or whatever. And I just think that we're going to be dealing with this for quite a while yet. Even if you just hear the rhetoric from Republicans and Democrats in Congress, the Republicans are talking about still wanting to go after Hillary Clinton for her email server, regardless of whether or not she wins. Democrats talking in very harsh terms about FBI Director Comey for releasing this letter related to the email server investigation. And so I think that we are going to be dealing with the fallout of this for some time to come.
Since, Danielle, as you're pointing out, voting laws vary by state state, and voting technology varies by state. And you can go into one place and pull a lever. You can go into another place and push a button. Do you think any type of standardized national approach to this would change either the way we think about our laws or the way we think about, as Kimberly said, the potential for a lot of drama after November 9th?
You know, I feel like having actual standards would help greatly. I don't see it necessarily happening. Despite the fact that, you know, we have a very old and great democracy, people aren't necessarily as engaged in it as much as they should be. There are people who are very passionate about standardizing things, but it's not enough of a groundswell to actually make real change.
I'm going to let you actually throw out your short now because you're what? You're short the thing Kimberly's long?
Yes, I am. I am short because the election will end. There's a definite end date where the election will end and we'll have someone will be president-elect.
Everybody can take a nap.
It'll be over soon.
Even though I believe the drama will continue, I am looking forward to the election itself wrapping up.
All right, give us your short, because yours is also election-related, but I guess sort of in a very particular job category.
Yes, I'm going to go short job prospects for Democratic operatives, because with all of these WikiLeaks dumps, it's like as if...
Of Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's emails.
Yes, of all of those emails. It's almost like, you know, you were gossiping with your friends in a private, like, chat channel, and then somebody printed it out and sent it to all of the people that you talked badly about, because... There's so much backroom dirt that's coming out in these things, and I imagine it's going to become increasingly difficult, regardless of how the election turns out, for people to sort of operate in the fishbowl that is Washington, D.C., with all the dirty laundry that's out and about. That's sort of on a personal level in terms of how people are talking to each other. But on the other side of that, there's actual jobs. If Hillary Clinton wins, who she's going to put in her cabinet, who she's going to have on her transition teams, that would be a lot of the people who are mentioned in these emails who now have this trove of information out there about them. Some of it, you know, private conversations that were never meant to be public, that will probably become fair game as, you know, Congress is involved in confirmation hearings and as people look for other opportunities in the city.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, Danielle Belton from The Root, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Every so often on this show, we call up three mayors in different parts of the country, Georgia, Oregon, and Wyoming, to be specific, to get a sense of what the economy looks and feels like in their cities. And with just a few days left before Election Day, we wanted to check back in with them to see how their constituents were making sense of this crazy election season. First up is Mayor Dennis Mock in Dalton, Georgia. Good to talk with you again.
Well, Lizzie, good to be back.
What has the election and sort of this season brought out in your community as you see it?
I guess really the only insight I have into that is, and it's probably national trend too, everybody's still a little bit confused and uncertain as to what they really want and need out of this election. The manufacturing community here especially is hoping for the candidate with the least government regulation and the least government oversight and the least taxation of business. And they haven't really enjoyed the last 8 years of the Democratic regime in there.
Do you think that means that your city ends up going for Trump?
At least the business portion of us, yes.
The last time we talked, you were working on some regional economic development plans. How's that going?
Actually, we're still in that process. We're kind of closely connected to Chattanooga in that the Volkswagen plant up there has attracted a lot of outside manufacturers that feed into the auto manufacturing, and we're still trying to land a good fit for our industrial park here with some spinoff from that business up there. We're getting closer. We get a lot of hits, and they'll run out of land up around Chattanooga pretty soon, and they'll need us, and that's what we're waiting on.
You know, I'm curious because you obviously are in a manufacturing center, but also when you talk about, say, the Volkswagen operation in Tennessee, that's something that depends on international trade. It feels a bit to me like you're kind of in the middle of these two really hot button issues.
And we are. And our economy here also depends on world trade too. We're a global market in the floor covering industry, and as the housing industry and hospitality industry and anything to do with construction goes, we live and die by that.
So would you like to see more free trade?
Absolutely. Free and equal trade.
Do you feel like you're getting that from either of them?
You know, I don't really know all that much about the trade regulations, but I have heard that, you know, it's kind of one-sided in some fields that we take things in without much difficulty, but if we're shipping somewhere else, we may get taxed pretty heavily on the other end, and it's harder for us to get our goods in other countries than vice versa.
We ask people sometimes to sort of describe their economy, and how would you say your Dalton economy is now?
It's good and getting better and has a lot of potential. We are in the manufacturing community, as I said, and we're pretty well known for our low wage rate, which appeal to some of the bigger box stores. Look at our income rate here in Dalton, Georgia, and they don't come here because of that. So we're hoping to get a bump with another industry here that might increase our wage rate and give us a little more prosperity, a little different look here in Dalton.
When you say your low wage rate, would your community ever consider something like one of these mandatory minimum wage bills that have gone around in different cities and states?
No, I don't think so. That sounds like heavy-handed government, and I don't think we're really looking for that. We're looking for more of an industry or a company that wants to come in here and pay a little more and maybe up the wage scale a little bit without government intervention.
I'm going to talk to our other two mayors who we check in with, Louise Carter King in Wyoming and Biff Tabor out in Oregon. Any questions I should ask them?
Well, the same questions would be great. I'd love to hear their answers.
You got it. Dennis Mock, thank you very much.
All right, Lizzie, thank you.
We're going to continue our series of conversations with mayors around the country about the election and the economies where they live. Louise Carter King is the mayor of Gillette, Wyoming. Gillette's economy relies heavily on its coal and oil industries, and it's been struggling a bit this year. I asked Mayor Carter King how things are going now.
We have had a downturn. Energy prices have really dropped. I would say we're not quite where we were last year, but we are improving.
And when you think about, you know, what people in your city are going to go to the polls on or about, you know, what sort of issues do you think are top of mind for them?
Well, around here, I would say the economy is number one. And with the two candidates that we have, with Hillary saying that she's the statement she made that she later backed off, but she did say it, that she was going to shut down some coal mines and lay some coal miners off. I think it hit pretty hard around here. So there's not a whole lot of Hillary support.
Is there Trump support?
Yes. I think Cruz was who won, but Trump was a close second. So, yes, I think even though I think everybody realizes there's trouble with Trump, he, as far as our economy, would be the better candidate.
You know, when you think about your city, your city is one that's very sensitive to national energy policy. It really has a big effect where you are. Do you think whoever is in office next is someone that, you know, your city and state can work with when you think about kind of the economic future of your town?
Well, I sure hope so. We would like whoever gets elected to come and visit us so we can show them firsthand how responsible we are with the environment and, you know, with how we mine coal and how we handle our energy resources, which we have a lot. And I believe working with the administration is better than working against it. So, yes, I think we can work with them and show how, you know, coal can be good for our future and good for the nation.
You know, the last time I talked to you, we got a letter from a listener who said, well, why don't they diversify their economy? You know, fossil fuel in a lot of places, while it is a source of energy, is also unpopular because of the environmental effects. Have you thought about trying to kind of branch out and make Gillette prominent in other industries?
Sure. And we have been. What has been happening is just in the last year, there's been two companies, one that is already in production, another one who's getting ready to build a facility here to use the carbon from coal
Oh, yeah.
in a different way, rather than, you know, for power. that's been going really well. The one company here, Atlas Carbon, just received a $15 million loan from the state to put on another production line because they just received a big contract. And they use it for water filters. And they say that industry is really growing. You know, that's both for both sides. It's not burning the coal and worrying the environmentalists, but it is using a resource that we have plenty of for another product.
We've talked to you a couple of times since you've been in office, and I wonder, at this point in your term, what's kind of the top of your mind when you think about taking care of your city?
Well, I guess I would just have to say I traveled down to our state to talk to the governor and our other elected officials about making sure this local company, Atlas Carbon, could get that loan, because that meant more jobs for our city, plus, you know, more of a future in a different kind of industry. I would have to say that's still the top priority, is to try to help build our economy back to at least close to where it used to be.
Well, Louise Carter King, mayor of Gillette, Wyoming, as always, it's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate hearing from you and look forward to talking to you again.
And now, the last of our three mayors, Biff Traber, the mayor of Corvallis, Oregon. That's where Oregon State University is, which means a pretty highly educated workforce and a fair number of startups. I asked Mayor Traber what the election season is like in Corvallis.
Well, I think our area is a fairly democratic from a partisan point of view.
Yep.
Came out during the primaries where there was strong support for Bernie Sanders. But I think from a national election, there's just more frustration of, and now I'm perhaps part of my personal opinion with how strange this whole election has gotten. The more locally or regionally, we do have a major tax initiative on a statewide ballot. That's important because we've been struggling with as referred to around here, our two legs of the three-legged stool we should have. We only have property tax and income tax and have...
That's right, you have no sales tax in Oregon, right?
No sales tax, and we're trying something this fall to see if we can tax the out-of-state corporations, the big companies that do business here and manage to move their profits out of state so they don't pay as much income tax. And that's sort of the big statewide excitement.
You're in a pretty left-leaning area, as you mentioned. Does the tax issue kind of separate along party lines, or is it different? Is it more nuanced than that?
I think it's more nuanced, though there is a strong Republican position about being very careful about new taxes, though there is very strong bipartisan recognition or continued discussion that we've got to do something to solve the situation.
I'm going to ask you a variation on a question that I asked Dennis Mock, which is, you know, we talked a year ago, and you have described to us before on this show, you know, you're a university town, you got educated workforce, startup demographic. What has changed in the year since I have last spoken with you in your local economy?
Well, I think the biggest change is the up and running and becoming more embedded startup focus, entrepreneurial focus with the university. So on one side, that's the biggest change from an economic side. In terms of culturally and socially, I think we are continuing to build new connections to the university, students, faculty, staff, in more day-to-day activity and operation. An example is a recognition in the community of a need to focus more on a group we hadn't been focusing on as much, and that was international students and their families. We have a growing international student population, and many of them are bringing families, and a major part of that population is Muslim. And with all of the politics we were talking about earlier on a national level, there's a fair amount of reinforcing our value of being a welcoming community, particularly emphasizing that as part of the Muslim community.
Biff Shaper, thank you so much for talking with us, and I look forward to checking in again.
Well, happy to do that. These are always interesting conversations. So thank you for continuing to do it.
Been asking you to ask us your lingering election-related economy questions. Last week, we answered a question about the minimum wage and another one about campaign funding. This week, we have a question from Mary Beth Hebert in Atlanta, Georgia, who wrote to us on Facebook.
Well, I'm concerned about the trade agreements that we keep hearing about, primarily from their presidential candidates, especially from Donald Trump. Whenever I've heard any of the experts talk about the trade deals, they seem to think that they're kind of not that big a deal, that while there's, you know, all these billions of dollars in numbers, that it's kind of a net-net, you know, we brought in as many jobs as we lost, more or less. So I guess one of my questions is that actually the case? And secondly, it seems to be very controversial. And so I'm curious as to what are the controversial variables? What are the things that that some people think are relevant and some people think are not about these trade deals? What are the factors they're looking at?
To answer that, we've got Lee Ohanian, a professor of economics at UCLA. And here's what he had to say about trade deals.
Well, it is certainly the case that trade deals are very complex. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the proposed deal on the table now, that's several thousand pages long. But to kind of cut to the bottom line, you know, most Americans are better off with free trade deals. The International Trade Commission, which is a government agency that studies international trade, estimates the average American family is better off by about $10,000 per year because we have the opportunity to buy goods and services from other countries, which increases the variety of goods we have available. It also increases competition. And some countries can do some things better than us, and so therefore we're able to buy at lower prices. The issue is, how many jobs does it destroy? How many jobs does it create? It certainly is the case that Americans who work at low-wage, low-skill jobs have lost their jobs overseas, you know, over the last 20, 30, even 40 years. So the idea that opening up to free trade deals would enhance that, you know, the world now is such a globally competitive marketplace. The idea that if we open up a free trade deal with a particular country, whether we'll lose jobs, that's going to happen whether we open up that free trade deal or not.
Another question came in through our voicemail from Mark Kelsey in Cape May County, New Jersey.
My question is, what are the probabilities that either candidate's economic policies are going to be implemented given the state of Congress, whatever it is after the election, whatever the makeup is of the Senate and House? What are the probabilities that Donald Trump is going to have money to build a wall, that there's going to be money to replace Obamacare with something really, really great, and his tremendous tax cuts that he wants to implement? Likewise, for candidate Clinton, what are the probabilities that any of her economic issues are going to be passed, her tax on businesses leaving the U.S., student loan forgiveness, and her tax increases for people over $250,000 a year? What are the chances that any of these economic plans are going to be implemented?
For the answer to that question, we turn to our own Nancy Marshall Genzer in D.C. What do you think, Nancy?
Well, anything that has to do with money, that is raising revenue through new taxes, for example, those bills have to originate in the House, and that is according to the Constitution. So you really can't mess with that. When you're talking about Hillary Clinton's plans, a tax on people making more than $250,000, that would have to originate in the House because that would be a new form of revenue. Also, as far as student loan provision, student loan forgiveness that Hillary Clinton has talked about, she could probably do something like maybe a 3-month moratorium on student loan payments. She could do that by executive order directing the Department of Education to stop collecting payments for 3 months, maybe. But again, you would need a bill to do a rewrite and a major change of the student loan provisions. You would need Congress to get on board with that. You couldn't just do that. Same thing with Donald Trump's wall. You could finesse a little bit of it, maybe by taking part of the Department of Homeland Security's budget and saying that's meant to protect us and the wall would protect us. But if the wall, you know, would cost $5 to $10 billion, you couldn't finesse that. You would need Congress to approve spending that much money. And who knows whether that would get approved. So the bottom line here really is they might be able to do some tweaks, but they can't just, you know, with a wave of their hand, abolish Obamacare or build a wall or forgive student loans. They need Congress.
Next week, it is that season again. We are talking about holiday travel. So what are your tips and tricks for making it affordable and bearable? Let us know. Visit marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. It's perhaps not a surprise that during an election, especially one that gets a lot of attention, companies try to cash in. For the past 5 election cycles, 7-Eleven has let customers vote, kinda, with their cup choice. They can buy a red Republican coffee cup, blue Democrat coffee cup, or purple nonpartisan cup. The company then tallies up how many of each cup was purchased and posts the results online. And actually, their accuracy in the last 3 presidential elections has been pretty decent. Producer Levi Sharp went to a 7-Eleven in Manhattan's financial district to find out more.
My name is Hussein Syed. I'm the store manager at 7-Eleven, which is on 111 John Street, 2 blocks over from Wall Street in the financial district in Manhattan. So basically, there are 3 cups that a customer can come in and choose from. One is blue for the Democrat, red for Republican, and then there's a purple one where it's basically an undecided or independent. We scan the cup, and the customer can go online, or anybody can go online and see which cup is selling more. 7-Eleven has, in the U.S., over 8,000 locations all throughout the country. You would think that we'd get a decent sample. This area in particular is mostly commuters, right? So we have people coming in from the suburbs. I see about a 50-50 split, but I haven't personally witnessed any animosity between customers. Everyone seems to be taking it all in good stride. So
I don't usually buy a lot of coffee, but I saw that they had the promotion going on, so I wanted to make sure that I at least bought a Democrat cup, because I know that 7-Eleven, they'll publish the results at some point. It's very unscientific, obviously, but I wanted to make sure I got another blue Democrat cup in there.
Why? Because I'm for her.
I don't know if anyone actually looks at it. I don't think anyone's commented, so I got the Republican cup to support Donald Trump, the greatest candidate that's ever lived.
I picked this cup instead of the presidential cups because people judge you when you walk if you're a Republican or Democrat, and I don't want to listen to anyone. So I'm being neutral in 7-Eleven coffee.
That's the primary reason I didn't take either one of those cups, because they're really, really large.
I think it's very, very weird. Your vote counts, not a cup, you know? To me, that's going overboard.
This week, I joined our partners at the BBC to take a data-driven look at how America has changed in the Obama years, using audiographs, which are kind of graphs with sound. You can hear the entire show on the BBC World Service, but here's a taste with an audiograph looking at how employment has changed since 2009.
A packed concert arena. 20,000 people. That's how many jobs were being lost every day in early 2009. These people are here for a special concert that tells what's happened since. Notes are derived from the monthly unemployment data since January 2009. Low notes are low unemployment, high ones are high unemployment. Now the BBC presents the global premiere of U.S. unemployment rates since 2009.
can listen to the entire hour-long panel this weekend on the BBC World Service. And speaking of the BBC, we joined up with their podcast, The Food Chain, to take an edible look at politics. Or a look at edible politics. I don't know. One of those things. Can you name who said this? Quote, "Cultivators of the earth are the most virtuous and independent citizens." Yeah, okay, that was Thomas Jefferson. So his affection for farmers notwithstanding, this year's campaign has not paid much attention to our food or where it comes from. But food is actually pretty political. In this part of the show, our collaboration with the BBC show The Food Chain. Red food, blue food, what it all means for you. We're going to start with big food and big money in this election. I decided to start this story with an apple. It's a Cortland apple grown in New York's Hudson Valley. I know exactly where this bit of my food came from.
We grow about 80 varieties of apples.
That's Josh Morgenthau, a third-generation farmer who owns and operates Fishkill Farms. It's about 300 rolling acres 2 hours north of New York City, where my apple was grown.
You can see about 100 acres of apple trees, peaches, nectarines, and...
That's what I'm looking at down there, right?
Yeah. So you see pears on the other side of our vegetable field.
It was between a little windy and cold, pears, but he took me on a tour of his farm where we talked about his business, the election, and what he hasn't heard on the campaign trail, much talk about food or agriculture.
Although agriculture is still a big part of our economy, you know, we've gone in 100 years from a time when a large portion of the working population in our country were working on farms or were farmers, and we've gone to a place where farmers make up, you know, less than 2% of the population. And so people are not as directly connected to the land, and they're not thinking about how farming and food production affects their lives as much.
And he's right. Voters aren't being asked to think about American farmers in this election. But big food and agriculture companies, the ones whose businesses will be affected by presidential policies, are thinking about the election. And that translates into campaign donations. Here's how the money stacks up. As of late October, Hillary Clinton's campaign had received $1.8 million from agribusiness, a category that includes everything from companies that sell seeds and chemicals, like Monsanto, to grocery store chains, like Publix. Donald Trump's campaign has received $1.1 million, which reverses a pretty long-standing trend.
Well, it's really interesting because generally agribusiness, big ag, big food, gives to Republicans much more than Democrats.
That's Vivica Novak from the Center for Responsive Politics, which compiled data on how big food companies donated to political campaigns.
In fact, Democrats are lucky to get half the amount that Republicans get when we look at congressional donations.
Within the umbrella of agribusiness, Clinton tends to do well with organic food companies, while Trump takes the meat producers. It's always tough to know exactly why a company gives money to a candidate. Some always donate one way. Monterre, which produces chickens, for example, is a stalwart Republican donor. But in the case of Clinton's overall dollar lead, well, here's Vivica Novak again.
I think that that probably says that they are confident she's going to win and they want to be on the side of a winner.
It also helps that Clinton is a known commodity to a lot of U.S. food and agricultural producers. Professor Balin Lineken studies food law and policy at George Mason University.
You know, Trump said that a vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote for 4 more years of Obama. And I think that actually sounded pretty good to agricultural producers who have been reasonably content with the way things have gone.
Big food and agriculture also have their eye on something else, the Farm Bill. It comes up every 5 years in Congress, and the next one will be in 2018. The last bill was worth $956 billion.
80% of it, roughly, it goes to benefits for low-income people, people who can't afford to buy groceries. And the other 20% is what goes to, you know, in the form of farm subsidies and other programs that support America's agriculture industry.
Making powerful friends in Washington never hurts when a company tries to get what it wants in Congress. CRP data found that American Crystal Sugar, for example, splits its donations evenly between parties this year. Florida Crystals, another sugar company, gave 76% of its donations to Democrats, 23% to Republicans, while Altria, which owns Philip Morris, gave 79% of its donations to Republicans and 20% to Democrats. And then there are the campaign issues that might not seem on the surface like they affect our food, but certainly do, like the candidate's stances on international trade and immigration. Here's Baylin Linnigan again.
Under a President Trump, if we deport 2 million people south of our border, who's going to pick our food? Who's going to cook our food?
Immigration is an issue where some of the biggest companies that grow food and a family farmer like Josh Morgenthau see eye to eye. He has a crew of 8 workers who come each season from Jamaica on special visas.
We can't fill those positions locally. We'll post for them and we won't get applicants. So anyone who says you're taking American jobs away, I haven't seen evidence that Americans actually want those jobs.
So he's watching the immigration debate very closely and has also talked with his senator about the 2018 Farm Bill. Before I left Josh Morgenthau's farm, I did make him introduce me to some of the supporting players in his business.
See how my chicken wrangling skills are these days.
Hello. How are you? Who is this?
Let's call her Suzanne.
And what do you think about my microphone?
She's a 2-year-old Rhode Island Red cross. She's one of the about 800 birds that we have on pasture, and in return she lays really, really delicious eggs for us.
Thank you, dear. Remember at the top of the show I asked, do you think you could tell from someone's diet how they vote? I mean, are there such things as red foods and blue foods? Reporter Vanessa Barchfield has this story of whether food choices can predict politics.
Greetings. My name is Harold Grant Hallman.
I meet Harold outside of the courthouse in downtown Tucson. He's an older white guy and has just been excused from jury duty.
How would you describe yourself politically?
Probably liberal.
And by liberal, he means he's a Democrat. Harold ate granola for breakfast. He has a protein bar peeking out of his shirt pocket and says, like most days, he'll eat an apple for lunch. I ask him to describe how he imagines a typical Republican meal.
It's really difficult to tell. I know that if they support Trump and his 200-word vocabulary, they could eat just bacon.
And Harold's not alone. Here are some of the other responses I get.
Something very staple, like meat and potatoes.
Something meaty, beef, perhaps?
Gotta be the barbecue ribs.
That last voice belongs to Kate Shirakova, who I should say doesn't vote in this country. She emigrated from Belarus 9 years ago. I ask her if she were eligible, who she'd be supporting for president.
Just like Mr. Putin said, we will work with whoever this country elects to be a president. That's your choice, guys.
We're chatting in the food court at one of the malls in town. Her lunch...
coffee and cigarettes.
...is about as politically ambiguous as her choice for president. Now, when it comes to a typical Democratic meal...
I go with a kale salad. Liberal people usually more into their health.
And guess what? She's not the only one who says that.
Maybe a salad or something with fruit. I don't know.
I suppose stereotypically people might think Democrats tend to be vegetarian, gluten-free weenies.
Jeez, like a Caesar salad or mixed salad of some sort, I guess.
That last guy is Ethan Lowe. He's just cracked the lid on takeout from the fast food Chinese shop Panda Express.
And their fried rice, chow mein, and their orange chicken.
He's a Republican and, in fact, describes a typical Republican meal like this.
Orange chicken and Panda Express. No, I'm just kidding.
Ethan hasn't decided yet who to vote for.
In my opinion, both candidates have good qualities, good policies, and they also have some negatives that I don't like.
He says none of those positives or negatives has anything to do with what the candidates may be eating. Democrat Catalina Cristofi is very clear about how she makes up her mind.
I go for anything that is to save the planet and help people.
Catalina's from Mexico. She's a U.S. citizen and has been here for almost 3 decades. Is she considering a vote for Trump?
No way, Jose.
I'm going to read you a few different foods, and you can tell me if you think they're more Republican foods or Democrat foods.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to interrupt myself here to tell you that this list of foods comes from Time magazine. It analyzed data from an online delivery service to figure out what foods were ordered the most in Republican districts and in Democratic ones. Okay, a hamburger.
Oh, sounds Republican to me.
Republican.
Republican. Chicken tikka masala.
I don't even know what that is.
Democrat.
Why Democrat?
That sounds healthy. I don't even know what it is, but it sounds healthier.
Lentil soup. I would say very Democratic.
Very Democratic. Why would you say that?
Because very green. No, maybe not even Democratic, even green, I would say.
Lentil soup.
Democrat.
How about a mozzarella stick?
Democrat.
Mozzarella stick.
Oh. Gotta go Republican on that one. Fried.
Mozzarella stick probably is more Italian or something like that.
Not Republican or Democrat.
Probably probably either of those, neither of those two. Okay.
Now, here's independent Jeremy Newell on what he imagines Donald Trump may be eating.
Probably a Big Mac and a large fry.
And Hillary?
Maybe a nice salad. Should probably live longer.
Okay, who knows what's actually on their plates? But all this talk of food, it's making me want to go vote. In Tucson, Arizona, I'm Vanessa Barchfield.
Vanessa Barchfield is a reporter at Arizona Public Media. If you remember the 1992 presidential campaign, you no doubt remember a dust-up in which Hillary Clinton, whose husband was then running for president, caught some flack for saying that instead of being a successful lawyer, she could have, quote, stayed home and baked cookies. It was a thing. And it gave rise to a cookie recipe contest published in Family Circle magazine. Every election cycle since, potential first ladies, and now a potential first husband, submit their cookie recipes, which go to a public vote. Regina Rigone is the food director at Family Circle magazine. Here she is with the BBC's Kent DePinto.
The test kitchens were always run by home economists who would develop these great recipes that, you know, readers would be able to read and reproduce at home. And it's really changed because there's no more home economics. It's a lot of chefs doing this work now.
Can I ask you, what is a home economist?
A home economist is somebody who, I don't know if you've taken home economics in food, but it's basically about how to run the home, you know, cooking, sewing, house cleaning. So unfortunately, it's not in the schools. Actually, a few schools still have it because people don't know how to cook at all anymore. And all they're getting is like seeing all this stuff happen on the Food Network and contests and, you know, fancy chefs who are doing all this really cool stuff. But they can't literally make themselves a piece of toast at home or scrambled eggs. And so you have a whole generation of people out there that don't really know how to take care of their families or cook or do basic stuff. And now we see this resurgence of interest in food and cooking and learning this basic stuff. And it's like the first time it's ever been done. But, you know, this home economics has been around a long time.
Speaking of contests.
Yes.
Tell us, what is the First Lady Cookie Contest and how did it come into being?
Okay, it started. I just happened to be at the magazine. I was young then. It was 1992. Hillary Clinton was on the campaign trail with her husband, Bill Clinton, and I guess somebody was interviewing her or asking her about some funds that Bill Clinton was putting in her program she was involved in. And she said, you know, I could have just been like a woman home, you know, like baking cookies and having teas.
I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was to fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life.
And unbeknownst to her at the time, it really set off a firestorm because a lot of people were like, well, that's what I do. I'm home cooking. What's wrong with that? I make cookies and I spend time with my kids. So I didn't think anything of it when she said it. I mean, it was 1992, so it wasn't like it was the 50s or anything. And I just thought, oh, all right, you know, most women are working, so it doesn't really refer to a lot of women. But people really took offense to it. And the PR director at our magazine at the time was like, we got to do something with this. And so let's throw down the gauntlet and see if she can really make cookies. And so we started this presidential cookie contest. And I really didn't think anything of it at the time, but it really picked up a lot of energy. And I remember coming into work every day having to make these damn cookies to send out to all these press people to try. And it just got bigger and bigger. She actually got really into it and she started baking cookies and giving them out. And she was doing her cookies against Barbara Bush's cookies. And they were both chocolate chip cookies, but Hillary's had oatmeal in it. So they won. And then 4 years later, we did it again. And we've been doing it every presidential election. And all but one of the elections, the person who won the cookie contest won the presidential contest. So that's kind of like it's got this, you know, special mystique about it.
Do you think they actually develop these recipes? Because I would imagine if you're a presidential candidate or the spouse of a presidential candidate, maybe baking a batch of cookies.
It's not your first priority.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Yeah.
How much of this do you think is sort of a PR move to kind of say, hey, I'm relatable. I'm just like you. Look at my cookie recipe.
I think that definitely has some part. But you also have to realize these people do eat and they do probably like this. But there's definitely a PR element involved in it, of course.
Now, your job is to look at these recipes and sort of evaluate them technically as a cookie recipe. Do they produce an excellent cookie?
Yes.
How do they weigh up?
Well, this year we had the recipe, which we've done before, and it's great. It's a chocolate chip oatmeal cookie. Works really well, and we really like it. The Melania Trump cookie was interesting because when we first saw it, it was like, oh, this is not like a recipe that we would normally get. Why it made me think it was authentic was because it was a type of recipe, you know, that maybe a grandmother would have written down years ago because it didn't have a lot of specifics. Because back then, people didn't need a lot of specifics. You just told them, okay, here are the ingredients, put it together, because most people knew how to bake. It was not polished enough to be a recipe that we would do in modern day. And it was also very plain. And this presidential contest, the Clinton cookie won again by 3-1 margin. And I think it's because people like, you know, it's a chocolate chip, you know, oatmeal cookie as compared to this plain biscuit type cookie that was not very sweet that Melania gave us to try.
Some people might say, is this really necessary? Does a woman whose husband happens to be running for president have to prove her domestic prowess to sort of gain the affections of the voting populace?
You know, I'm thinking it's less and less, and it's interesting because this year we almost gave up on the contest. We almost thought, you know, maybe this is done already and people aren't doing it. But then it picked up steam again. And I think it's just because people want that relatability of somebody at home making cookies.
Do you think this contest will happen in 4 years' time?
I don't know. You know, this year was a very hard year to do it, and it almost didn't happen, so it might not. I think, you know, it's so interesting because I was, like, reviewing all the presidential cookies, and there's so many. It's kind of confusing. You know, who did what? When did they do it? There were three people 1 year. And so there's been a lot of commotion and energy put into this, which is really interesting that here we are. We started this in 1992. I was just working in the test kitchen now. Now I'm, like, the head of the food department of the magazine. So there's been so much changes just as far as what people are cooking, technology, all these things, but yet these cookies still remain. So I think cookies are just one thing that might always stay because people love them, and it's a warm, comforting thing, and we need that in this day and age.
And that's our show for this week. Next week we're talking about holiday travel, so we want to know your tips and tricks for making it affordable and bearable. Come tell us. Visit marketplace.org, go on our Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. And Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.